So you just made your transition, right?
Yeah, something about faces melting, and then there was giggles.
Faces perfect. Melting.
Perfect.
Whose face wouldn't melt after 250 podcast episodes?
Hey, wow.
Thank you for listening to Game of Thrones, everyone. This is a podcast. I'm putting my arms around everyone right now.
Oh, That's a lot. That's big arms.
Yeah, they're kind of big.
You've been working out?
I got a wingspan.
Did you know that your arm span is within inches the equivalent of your height? Yeah, mm-hmm. Kate knew that. She knew that.
I associate that fact with Michael Jordan for some reason.
Oh, I do with Dan Brown. I think yours is probably better.
Dan Brown, the author of Da Vinci
Code? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, like he's talking about
Dan Brown, the Hall of Fame basketball player.
Yeah, who?
Dan
yeah.
Brown, the professional rollerblader.
Oh man, yo, we have earned rollerblades though. We are this past year has gone by in a blaze of glory, and I just want to say that this has been our best year yet on Game of Thrones. And for those of us who've been listening to us for even half or a third of these 250 episodes, we're just thrilled to have you here with us.
I cannot believe we've made it to 250 episodes. This is really cool.
Let's celebrate.
Here's to at least 250,000 more episodes.
Gosh, 250,000.
I don't know if that'll happen.
That's a lot.
We probably have to make 3 or 4 episodes a day for the rest of our natural lives.
Some of you at home who read into us may appreciate that.
Some of you may not.
You know, it's funny because these books are not any less interesting than they were when we first started them. Actually, the show as well. I think we started with just discussing the TV show season 1. Or was it 2? No, 2 was starting. Mm-hmm. But we have managed to keep talking about things, and it has managed to continue to interest us. I know that just today, these chapters are made some of the best adapted moments in the TV show. And, you know, reading them for the first time for 2 of us and the other 2, you know, revisiting them, it still has this pull on us. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's still exciting. And this world is great. All right. Thank you, Micah.
You're right.
Like,
no.
On the last episode, Micah said at the end, he was like, well, we've got a Dany and a Sansa chapter ahead of us. And I was like, great. But I regret that because they're amazing chapters. Mm-hmm. These are, again, I realized that this cluster of plot in the middle of Storm of Swords is so pivotal and iconic and full of these rich, huge moments.
Yeah.
Both of these chapters are insane.
They're very good.
They're very good. And actually, Anara Snow on Watchers on the Wall, she made a comment about our comment. And
that's meta.
It is meta. and I'd like to read it. I'd like to share it with all of you on this 250th episode.
Yeah.
She starts out by saying, there's just one comment in this episode I really don't understand. The apparently sarcastic comment about the upcoming Dany and Sansa chapters.
Oh. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that.
But she doesn't name names.
No, Kate. But she's talking to me. But and Kate.
She's Mike. Above that. She's really above that.
Well, my comment was meant to be sarcastic, so she did at least pick up on that. Mm-hmm. To me, the comment would have made a lot more sense without the sarcasm. Why wouldn't everyone be excited about them? Or Catelyn's chapters, for that matter. I can see why Bran's chapters wouldn't be seen as the most exciting, since not a lot happens to him. Even though we get some great information, like the Night of the Laughing Tree story.
Very true.
And I can understand why Essos, in general, would not be seen as the most exciting location. But Dany's chapters in Astapor are really strong and much more exciting than most of what's going on in Westeros at this point in the book. But Sansa has great chapters in A Storm of Swords, and so does Catelyn. We see the entire Stark campaign and her and Rob's tragedy, and one of the book's high points is in her chapter. Whose chapters are supposed to be better at this point? Davos's and Jon's chapters were really nice, but they're not nearly as big in terms of events as the 2 upcoming chapters, Daenerys 3 and Sansa 3, which are among the strongest and, in my opinion, best in this book. And they are certainly the most eventful and important of the book so far. In addition to Sam's chapter, the 2 latest Catelyn chapters, and Jaime's latest chapter.
I agree.
She makes a good point here.
She's totally right. Yeah.
I think, you know, we presupposed a little bit just based on the names and the track record of these two characters. This, you know, Daenerys in particular has been somebody who I think a lot of us have stated her story just doesn't pick up a lot of steam. You know, it seems to be a lot of the same, but in this chapter, certainly, which we're going to talk about, it's one of the more powerful scenes, I would say, in the entire book. And then with Sansa, it's somewhat of a defining moment. And, you know, we can get more into it when we talk about the chapters, but I think, you know, Inara she's right. And, you know, we shouldn't presuppose.
For the record...
You didn't presuppose?
No. I've been looking forward to these chapters.
The people who've already read.
Yeah, well, it's because I didn't know what chapters are coming. I haven't been like peeking ahead to read and see what's actually happening. For me, Daenerys, especially coming off of book 5, Daenerys's chapters are something that I have come to dread just because there's a lot of it gets to be pretty heavily just like politics and so I associate her with dullness, but it's incorrect because Storm of Swords is a really exciting book for her. And Sansa, I'm just so tired of reading about dresses. And
no, and I wanted to bring. I'm going to read it. I'm going to quote.
Well,
the
fortunately
dress
for you, she takes it off in this chapter.
She does. She does. But I do love the description of her dress. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I do too.
Yes.
Let's talk about Daenerys.
It was beautiful.
First,
Daenerys.
This is the chapter where she has maybe one of her most iconic scenes, certainly from the show. The Great White Hope kind of. Situations that she keeps getting herself into. She was criticized for that on the show because she does end up being this like white face in a sea of brown people who are all excited to see her, you know, which is kind of unfortunate. But I don't get that same feeling from this chapter because they make there's a strong point being made that we talked about last week about how, you know, multicultural and many colored this army of slaves is. So I think maybe the show didn't do such a good job of representing it as being such a colorful thing. Anyway, she frees the slaves. She takes one step toward this mother of dragons figure of legend that she's making herself out to be.
I know some of the things often when we discuss this chapter, one of the first things we always go to is kind of the end, just because these chapters have a way of ending in a really big way. But I mean, if I could just, you mentioned the freeing of the slaves, and if there's really any battle cry that is the best battle cry you could ever utter, I really don't think you're going to top freedom. It's freedom! Or was it the Valyrian word for freedom?
Dracarys! I think Dracarys means fire.
It does.
That's her command to Drogon when she's telling him to melt faces.
That's what I do every time before I go on like to do a music set. We're just
Dracarys!
You got to name your band Dracarys. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think she was yelling freedom. Also, go melt faces.
Because she does. Yeah. At one point, she yells freedom, and then she starts yelling Dracarys. And I'm like, I inferred from context clues, but no, she actually wants the city to burn. She actually wants it to burn. Interesting.
Yeah. This chapter is full of amazing stuff, like descriptions of clothing. You definitely have a vivid mental picture, at least I do, of exactly what everybody's wearing and how hot it is and the fringes on the tokars of the great masters and everything else.
Yeah.
It just seems like such hedonism in this town of Astapor, and you resent it somehow, even though I think that American culture is pretty hedonistic in a lot of ways. This particular Astaporian culture, George Martin makes you very aware of how resentful you should be of these people. Yeah, they're totally unsympathetic. Completely.
Toward the beginning of the chapter, there's this paragraph that kind of, I feel like George did a really great job of setting up, apart from the physical things that were there in our minds, giving us the perspective that these men that she's communicating with, these heads of the slavers, the eight brokers that are kind of the dudes that all control their own parts, their own branches of slavery, but they come together for the big sales like this. Like they're united by their ancestors through the Unsullied. And this is a big sale for them, so they're excited. And it says, each of the eight brokers was attended by two or three body slaves.
So this is each person has their own people that just follow them at all times, which is very indulgent, as Kate was saying. Let's get real here. The one Grazden, the eldest, had six. So, of course, the eldest had to have six other fully grown humans to just accompany him as he went about his business.
Right. Yeah.
That's more than I think Donald Trump would ever even consider doing. And so this is we can understand what's happening here. It says, so as not to seem a beggar, Dany had brought her own attendants, Eerie and Jaqui, in their sand silk trousers and painted vests, Old Whitebeard and Mighty Bawas, her blood riders. Sir Jorah stood behind her, sweltering, in his green surcoat with the Black Bear of Mormont embroidered upon it. The smell of his sweat was an earthy answer to the sweet perfumes that drenched the Astapori. Very clear setup here.
She's like, Jorah smells, but not nearly as badly as these guys do with all their perfume.
Although there is this contrast that Dany is making between herself and the masters, she points out that they have slaves and these people are attending them, but she also has attendants. And the difference to her is that these attendants follow her because they choose to. And I wanna ask you guys if you think maybe that's true. Because of course they could leave at any time. They've come to her service of their own accord in some cases not. Jorah was sent there to spy on her and is now in love with her. So both of his motivations are really questionable. Eerie and Jaqui might just die if they just take off in the middle of the desert or become enslaved by someone else. So what choices do they really have? And conversely, the great masters have these attendants, and sure, they're slaves and they've been slaves their whole lives. But as Dany finds out, if you free a slave and they've been doing something their whole life, are they actually going to be able to live a fulfilling existence after they attain something as what she deems wisely or not as being as valuable as freedom? You know, does freedom actually give them that much freedom?
So I want to answer your first question about whether or not what she's doing is like whether they're there of their own accord. There's a statistic in this chapter when she talks about her Khalasar, about how there's 86 members of her Khalasar, men, women, and children, but 86 out of the 10,000 that Khal Drogo had.
I think it was 100,000 that he had.
Oh, was it 100,000?
Yeah, because I remember trying to visualize 100,000.
Yeah, this chapter is great for that. Like there are, if you think about like 8,000 and some Unsullied, like all in this courtyard or wherever it is that they are with all of these other people who turned up to watch. Yeah, Plaza of Punishment, where all these other people have turned out. It's crazy to think about how many bodies are actually there and how many vests they all have to wear. You know, did we all fully
How many
clothed?
Pointed helms.
Yes. How many phallic symbols they're wearing on their helmet. But I think, Kate, that the sheer number, like how few there are, would benefit the notion that these people are there of their choosing, because we see just that in that number, so many other people have left. You know, maybe it was just something as simple as when everyone else was leaving, they hesitated and are now stuck with Dany. But I think it's more than that. I mean, these are the people who I think genuinely have to believe in what she's trying to accomplish as much or as little as they know about it, just because they're still there when so many, like, you know, 99,000, you know, 914 people are not there.
Right.
Good math. Good math. Plus, they all bone down together. So,
right.
No, I tend to agree with what you said, Eric. I think that there, of course, is an alternative in all this, right? They could leave her, but the question is, where are they going to go?
Yeah, to what end?
Right.
Do they join Cal Pono or one of the other Cals and be subservient anyway? I feel like even though they are in service to Dany, they have certain freedoms that they otherwise would not. And they're able to enjoy their lives maybe a little bit more than they would in other situations. I just don't know that they would have the alternative to go and live in one of these cities and just become a normal human being.
I think for the most part, their setup is great. Considering what some of them went through in the earlier books with Daenerys as she was making her way across the sea, as it were, the dirt and sandy sea.
Yeah.
You know, it's much easier now. They have the spoils of Karth. They have the spoils of what they've been able to take after terrible situations took place in Dany's life. So And I feel like now is not the time, like, for there to be any reconsideration of their situation.
Yeah.
Just comparing her attendance to theirs, like, I'm sure their slaves are great, and I'm sure Grozden has six really wonderful slaves, but Daenerys is rolling up with strong Belwas. Let's get real here. Mm-hmm. Arston Whitebeard, a.k.a. Barristan Selmy. Jorah Mormont in his big-ass green surcoat with his black bear embroidered on it. And then he's got... she has the Dothraki with the bells in their hair. It's just, it's hard to think about it because we're in the middle of it, but in 100, 200 years when she is dead and gone and whatever ends up happening with the story, like this will be part of the legend that's passed down. Like she walked up with these people in the city of Astapor. Yeah. And then what took place, you know, like we're in the middle of this legend being made right now.
You know, it is funny because there are far less of Dany and her people than there are of the people that she's buying. You know, there aren't 8,000 people that Dany has, but she's buying 8,000. Like, she's adding to her numbers, but she's so much smaller. And so, tactically, it's really smart for her to show up with pretty much everybody that she can grab. Everybody that she has, either initially in this chapter or once the actual buying takes place, where they're all carrying, you know, as much as they can possibly carry of her goods and spices and things. Like, it's smart to have her not look both A, like a beggar, like it says in that paragraph you read, but also in general, just like a little girl who's without an army or like without any, she has to pose enough of a, you know, threat, like the dragon has to have enough gravitas, this promise of a dragon, that, you know, they go for this deal, because otherwise she gets turned down.
And this deal making was interesting, because we find out there's 8,000 people that are ready and willing to be purchased, and then there are 600, six centuries of soldiers that are, they don't want to sell them not in around 1,000, which I find so interesting, the mathematics to this, because some of the other masters are like, well, we could just, you know, sell them and get them out of the way. We don't really have to necessarily round them out to 1,000. And Krasnus is such a perfectionist. He's like, no, like they have to be perfect. Like, you know, they have to sell them in ranks of 1,000 and no unfinished slaves. It's just interesting to me, their amount of attention to detail with her product line. It's kind of inspirational. Mm-hmm.
Dany wants the puppies too. She's like, any life she can save, you know, like she doesn't reveal that to them, but it like could give her away. She just says that she'll pay as much for the boys who have not yet, you know, killed or whatever, as she will for the full grown soldier. I don't know. That should have been kind of a tip or a hint as to her motivations. But one of the things I want to mention with this chapter is that, unlike the show, in the show it's hidden, but the book point of view character, it's still cleverly, George still cleverly masks what she's really feeling. Like when she walks away from the first, you know, the deal, when she's first promised her dragon, she feels like, oh no, what have I done? And it's not really revealed until the very end of the chapter that she, you know, what her plan is. But even though it's her point of view chapter, we're still, as readers, you know, blinded to her true intentions until she starts calling for everybody to get their heads cut off.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And she does a really good job of, there's several times when she talks about how hard a decision this was for her, but there's no other choice. And she thought about it for a long time. She cried. And then she tells them that she intends to sell her dragon in exchange for these Unsullied. And Arston Whitebeard is like, yo, do not do this. Is dumb. Don't do it. But she like dismisses him. And you think like, oh my God, Dany, this is too much. This is such a foolish idea just for your crown. And I think now that instead of her, you know, worrying and crying about the idea of selling her dragon, since she didn't actually ever intend to do it, obviously, what has been hard for her is that she has chosen to play God and decide who lives and who dies and kill a lot of people. And that's like, that to me seems like the actual moral dilemma that she had to go through. Because like I said, her dragon was someone else's for about 10 seconds. What's also interesting to me is that this is exactly, maybe not exactly, but in a lot of ways, very similar to what Viserys did to Dany, that she resents him so much for, which was selling her in exchange for an army.
Yes.
He of course went through with it, but in many ways it's similar, and it's something that, even as I say, she never intended for this to actually be a sale. she had to control that situation so carefully so that Drogon didn't get carried away, so that she didn't get held at spear point until he was secreted off somewhere else. There's a lot of things that could have gone wrong here, and she had to be so careful and not show her full hand and come off as truly, truly desperate.
Yeah. Going back to what you were first talking about, though, I think that what Whitebeard did actually worked in her favor.
Because he believed her, right?
Absolutely.
He believed her. It made it seem more like she was actually going to follow through with that.
She was desperate, yeah.
Absolutely. And I like that little sidebar that the two of them had where she basically says, I'll take your counsel anytime that you want to give it to me, but don't do it in front of other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she scolds him, even though what he did probably lended credibility to her cause.
She says, you must not presume to instruct me. Ser Jorah, remove Whitebeard from my presence. Damn.
It reminds me of that scene in Godfather 2 when Fredo he sides with someone else against the family. I think it's Godfather 2, it might be 1. But Fredo's like in the hotel. Have you guys seen Godfather?
I've seen 1, but I haven't seen 2.
Ah.
You broke my heart.
Yeah, you broke my heart, Fredo. But this is the part where he's in the hotel and it is the first one because it's before he kills the heads of the 5 families. But Fredo's like, "Yeah, you gotta just listen to this hotel guy." And then Michael has to take him aside later and he's like, "Never take sides with me against the family."
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is more of a Lannister thing, maybe.
Well, I just love, Kate, going back to what you were saying really quick, this revelation that her feelings, how she can't sleep that night is, it's real. It's not necessarily, I feel deceived when reading this chapter, but you suggested that her feelings are real. The reason she can't sleep, instead of the being that she is trading her dragon, it's that she's sanctioning the deaths of all these masters.
And that's such an interesting thing to be a part of, because I feel like we've had terrible battles and we've had terrible losses in this story alone. But how often do we get to have the perspective of someone that's about to make that move and that's about to make that decision? And how perfect is it that it's someone that we know is as, I don't want to say as green as Daenerys. She's young, but she's been through a whole lot. It certainly it isn't in her wheelhouse to be this kind of person and to make this kind of decision. So knowing what happens, and I knew what happened in this chapter because of all of the owns that were sent to us. I didn't know that this would be the chapter that it happened in.
Not the picture I posted.
That's
what makes it so great, though. And at the same time, what makes it so crazy is that you're reading this chapter from her perspective, yet he's able to write it so that you have absolutely no clue what she's about to do, which is so weird because normally when you're reading from a character's perspective, you're inside their mind. Like, you get that italicized internal monologue.
Yeah.
Yet you see none of that in this chapter. And it begs the question, maybe she didn't know what she was going to do up until that morning. Though, this is certainly something that you think she'd take a little bit of time deciding what she was going to do. But the fact that she was restless maybe has more to do with the fact that she was actually going to move forward with this and there's really no turning back.
So maybe there was no planned deception necessarily into the last minute.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah, that could be it. Or I'm saying that she was restless because she was nervous about what was about to happen. She was about to make a big power move and bring down this entire city and the slavers that control it. And that's got to weigh a lot on her conscience. Going back to what was said before about, having the spears thrust at her throat and Drogon taken off somewhere. There's a real possibility that could have happened because let's face it, the numbers were not in her favor.
Nope.
But she made sure that, that the words were spoken, that the deal was done so that the Unsullied heard it before she made any of her moves, which was smart.
She also made sure to speak with Missandei in the litter when she freed Missandei. Missandei was given in this case as a token of goodwill from Krasnus after their bargain had been struck, which was basically all of the goods that they have, including their ships and Drogon, in exchange for, I believe, the 8,000 soldiers and the 6 centuries. So, I mean, depending on where your value is in an army, the deal was that. So opinions abound. But she's speaking to Missandei, And I feel like this is where maybe we should have had a little bit of a giveaway that there was more to the situation than we knew, because she was very interested in how well they would listen once she had the baton, essentially. Once she got the fingers of the harpy, like if they would have any sort of resolute stiffness to their previous masters, especially, you know, maybe standing in the same place that they trained for such a long time. And she learns that they're going to pretty much listen to whatever that person holding that thing says. So I think maybe in that moment, she understood that it was a risk, but a calculated risk that was right. worth taking.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, it's so Targaryen of her to burn everybody. Can we talk about that for a second?
So Targaryen.
Such Targaryen.
Targaryen.
I think we had some foreshadowing that this was not actually going to be something that she stuck with, because there's a point near the beginning of the chapter where she's walking with her posse, and she says, yeah, like, I should have a banner made with the key to the dragon on a field of fire. And then she gives away her dragon, which would make a three-headed dragon kind of seem silly. So I think that's like another indication that she never actually planned to give up her dragon. But in this chapter, I remember reading this for the first time and be like, what? Why would you give your dragon away, you crazy woman? And this is such a George Martin thing to do. He does this thing where it's just like, you know, shit happens, things change, and ideals and icons mean nothing. You got to do what you got to do to get shit done. So I was fully on board with the fact that she was giving away a dragon in order to get this crazy army.
Yeah, you get sold. You get sold.
What did you
on
think,
it?
Mecca, when you read it for the first time? Did you think it was like for real?
I can't remember, honestly, but I'm sure I would think it was for real. There's no reason not to believe it, right? It's very clear that this is what she's going to go through with. And if you're reading it without any sort of foresight and you don't have the TV show to use, you would think that she's going to move forward with this. Mm-hmm. And there's no decisions that she has made previously, at least in my opinion, that would make you think that she's going to do anything other than that at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're a reader for the first time reading this chapter, you're going through it and you're saying, oh man, Daenerys, what are you doing? Like, she comes across as almost being desperate by making this move. But you know, from reading through this chapter that's what Krasnus and his goons, so to speak, his council and his, I don't know if you call it a council, but you know, all those slavers, the end game is the dragons. That's what they want. And you know, there's a whole, you know, part of this chapter that talks about the negotiation side of it. And you knew at the end of the day, it was coming down to a dragon. They want it. It's ingrained in their history, right? It says five times old Gis contended with Valyria when the world was young, and five times gone down to bleak defeat. Mm-hmm. For the Freehold had dragons and the Empire had none.
Okay, so that, yeah, I had a question about that, which is basically because these guys do want this dragon so badly, but they have this huge, like this factory, I want to say, this huge, all these machinations that are in place to build and breed these Unsullieds. Like, it works. It takes, what, 10 years for these soldiers to be bred. And that is what this city does. But yet, they want this dragon, but they have no infrastructure to support actually containing this dragon that we're aware of. Like, they want it so badly, but they can't handle the heat. Clearly, like, it's not just because it's not just because that once they get one, like, Drogon is still loyal to Daenerys and, you know, all that stuff. It's actually like they're not being very realistic with their greed is way over, you know, overpowering their common sense, I think.
Which is a lesson in the matter.
Yeah. Right. It's just like, stick to, like, yeah, it really, really is.
I mean, their greed is justified, don't you guys think? Because let's say you're the kind of people that do these kinds of things for a living, and you wear tokars, and you have different social statuses, comparatively speaking, to the kinds of fringe on your tokar, which is pretty interesting, George R. R. Martin. That was very vivid. Let's say you're that kind of person. The prospect of getting one of three of the rarest creatures on the planet, I don't think that you would be worried about. You'd be worried about the business side of it. You'd be like, let's just get them in our grasps and then worry about the business later.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Which is a lesson. I did not necessarily see it coming. I knew that something was afoot when there was a late night visitor.
Let's talk about that.
It just kind of came out of nowhere.
Talk about greatest hits, though, Game of Thrones. This goes back very early on. Captain Creepyface.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we called this person who visits Danny in the...
See, this is where the discrepancy happens, because I always thought Captain Creepyface was Pyat Pree, not Quaithe.
They were introduced like in the same episode, though, like Quaithe and... Captain, and I think it applies to both, clearly. But
no, it doesn't, because there's nothing creepy about her face. She's dressed like a Mortal Kombat character, right?
That's creepy. That's creepy.
No, it's not. That, you're saying creepy face. It implies that there's something wrong with the physical structure of their face.
But Pyat Pree is just bald. What's wrong with
him?
Pyat Pree is a dirty man.
Just bald. There's nothing wrong with baldness.
All that nightshade.
I guess Nightshade may have turned his lips blue, but
and oh, speaking of that though, Eric, there was a little bit more information. I think it was from Missandei about them drinking this.
I'm glad you mentioned this. Yeah, it's about I guess we questioned the last Danny chapter, or I did, like about how they may or may not have to keep drinking this in order to stay these cold-blooded killers. But apparently, I guess, do you have the quote? Or I remember what it said. It just said that after they drink it for the first couple of years, they're pretty much gone. Like, you don't need to keep drinking it. So
I had a feeling. It's a pretty strong hooch.
Yeah.
And also that several of her brothers are members of this.
Missandei had three brothers that were lost to this transformation. Which is just like, she's not allowed to have any emotion about it, but it doesn't strike me as altogether that cold when she tells Danny. It's just matter of fact. You know, Danny is finding out about these people. She's finding out about the Unsullied, and she asks Missandei these questions before she, you know, really completes the purchase. And it's kind of smart of Danny in that way.
So can I read this quote? Do you guys mind?
Yeah. Do it.
Yeah.
Remember. She is standing. I'll back it up a little bit. This is Daenerys thinking. She is standing over me. Who's there? Danny peered into the darkness. She thought she could see a shadow, the faintest outline of a shape. What do you want to me? That's a sentence. It goes on to say.
That's a sentence.
Remember, to go north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow.
Let's talk about what she's already completed, because I feel like she's already gone east to go west, right? Like, she went east across all of the Red Waste and found Karth, which you're not even supposed to be able to get to because it's so far, across dead nothingness. Like, I feel, and we know that she's been heading west ever since the beginning because she wants to go back to Westeros and reclaim her throne. So I feel like she's already gone east to go west. Thoughts?
Kate?
I you can't really answer this question if you've read the next two books.
Oh.
So I'm going to let you guys just posit your theories.
Well,
has she gone north
to me most is
travel south?
Touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow.
Is that like Melisandre's baby?
Who even knows? I don't think that it quite literally means just like walk, like play limbo with Melisandre's shadow baby. So interesting. And we can only hope that it was Quaithe. That visited her. But when she sprung from the bed and the door was thrown open and yellow lantern light flooded the cabin, she saw no one. Mm-hmm. No one was there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agree with Kate. Great point, Kate. Yeah. Two books, can't say anything.
Okay.
No.
My question was, where is she at currently? Like, it's explicitly stated in later books where she's at currently now, I don't see why you can't answer their question necessarily, unless you forget.
I was just being a bit sarcastic, but yeah. I think that, you know, the observations that you've made are observations that are fine up until this point in the story. I think that what you have said makes sense to me.
I'm just guessing
to Kate,
but
does it make sense to you, Kate?
Makes perfect sense to me.
I feel like she's done one of those things. I don't know about the others. I don't remember
to those of you playing at home. I raised my goblet of coffee.
Well,
one
other thing that was important during that that night was a dream that she had, where she thought she was Rhaegar riding to the Trident, but she was mounted on a dragon, not a horse. When she saw the usurper's rebel host across the river, they were armored all in ice, but she bathed them in dragon fire, and they melted away like dew and turned the Trident into a torrent. Some small part of her knew that she was dreaming, but another part exulted.
Sorry, there's no way you're melting Robert Baratheon.
Yeah.
Gods, he was strong.
Thank the gods.
Caved in his breastplate.
But is she talking about Robert Baratheon?
Like, is she actually seeing him, do you think?
No, I mean, usurper has been used for other people besides Robert. Robert's long dead.
But this is supposed to be a past event, right? Or are you thinking it's the
future?
Or
is it?
Oh, so she's, well, she sees herself as, what, Rhaegar. So we think it's in the past. So either she's in the past and it's like, you know, Robert and Ned at the Fist, or the Trident, sorry. Or she's in the future, but as her uncle. Or as her brother, sorry.
I think if anything, it's just her putting herself into the mind space of something that's already happened. Like, if this is some kind of a premonition and there is going to be some meeting of ice and fire, it's going to be her on the dragon. It's not going to be Rhaegar.
Well, that's where the dragon
comes in. Well, she was
in.
On the dragon.
Yeah, because she was on a dragon. I mean, she was him, but she was on a dragon's divorce. You know, I wonder if it's Greensight. Like, that'd be pretty cool if she was... If she's
any
now,
chance you get.
What? Oh, for the Greens? Yeah, go Children of the Forest. Rah, rah. Give me a C, give me an H, give me an I. You know.
I think it could be a bit of foreshadowing, you know, since she is on a dragon. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not it does obviously mention the Trident, so it is specific in that respect. But as far as usurper, I mean, you know, Joffrey and Tommen both, I think, are looked at as being usurpers by many. So, you know, and she mentions, though, that they were armored all in ice, but she bathed them in dragon fire.
Armored in ice. Huh.
And so we know winter is coming. Zing, see, I got it in there. For our 250th episode.
Oh, yeah, we had to
say
it.
We were able
once.
To include it.
Make sure.
We know winter is coming, and there's inevitably going to be some battles that take place, and we know she wants to return to Westeros with those dragons, and... Who knows? Maybe it's a bit of the past, but a bit of the future at the same time.
Can you imagine Daenerys flying into battle against the Walkers, and just against in general, just those icy, chilly foes? And they're all like rah, doing like the sounds and like battle stuff that they make, and she's like, "Fuck you!" Just blazing them with fire and just melting people.
I mean, it could be immediate foreshadowing as well. Her dream, because she does bathe people in fire the very next day. Krasny's eyes melt out and roll down his face.
Yeah, that's hot.
It's pretty hot stuff.
It's like fiend fire.
She
super,
shouts,
super hot.
Fire, fire, fire. Yeah, the dream is very interesting. Anytime one of our characters have the dream, you know, there's kind of, we go through the same steps. Is it Greensight? Where did this come from? Is it real? Can it be equated to Dany's trip in the House of the Undying? And let's remember the things that she saw there. That were very clearly, we could pick out a few that were premonitions. And so I think she does have the gift of foresight.
Well, she certainly has the gift of doing things in style. Not that that made much sense, but when the trade essentially happened the next day and her same attendants, and they were joined by a lot more of the Dothraki, filed into the Plaza of Punishment, because they couldn't be fit into the Plaza of Pride and a lot of other places. They had to kind of go to the larger area of Astapor. I did not expect what happened to happen in this manner. First and foremost, and I'm kind of skipping ahead of a few details, but when she was given the harpies of the harpies' fingers, the baton that's sort of like a cat of nine tails with the leather lashes and then the claws on the end of it, I did not expect her to do what she did with it, which was at one point, and this was right before the pivotal moment where things started to shift and she started to yell, she takes it. And the book describes it as destroying his face. Just it became a different face. She takes it and just rocks it across this dude's face and just rips Krasnus's face open. Like, shit.
Yeah. All of his features. Like,
fell to the ground.
70% of his features just aren't there anymore. Which.
Style.
It's stylish, and you're kind of like. You've been prepped for the last two chapters to be like, please, please wreck this guy. Please do something to him that is just the worst. And then she slashes his face with the claws of the harpy. And he's like, ah! And then she's like, hold on. And then her dragon melts his eyeballs and they run like liquid down his face.
Yep.
It's a pretty good way to take him out. After all of the abuses, he calls her a whore, what, like 34 times?
Yeah, a lot of times.
And a lot.
It's interesting too when she's about to she rides off and starts talking to the Unsullied, and she has the whip and she's speaking to them in perfect High Valyrian. None of the good masters are the oldest one. Is the only one who notices. He like whips his head around.
He's like, oh,
and
shit.
You know that guy was like, oh,
yeah.
Like it was just slow motion
in
dread.
Slow motion.
Yeah.
But like too slow, you know.
Arguing over, and I feel like the show, because all this is happening so quickly, I feel like the show did a great job of Krasnus's glee in that moment, because they were just so happy to pass the chain over. They brought the dragons in. And they took the roof off of her litter, and they were kind of anchored inside of it. So I'm seeing like this kind of cool, like mobile. I wish I had one for Strike, of like something to tether him to sometimes. and they hand the chain over. She hands the chain over, and then he passes the whip over at the same time. And then the book basically just captures the glee and how quick he is to like turn to his friends and be like, "Oh, what do we do?" And they're all shouting, like they're like giving Krasnus advice on what they should do with the dragon. And that's when they don't hear her shouting to the Unsullied, which I found so interesting. So much excitement at one moment.
I love both like equally, like in the book that he's so distracted by the dragon that he doesn't recognize, but I also love in the show when he realizes that he's been played from the start. Like all the times he called her whore, he's now like the whore of Westeros, he's now going to eat every single one of those words. Like I like this adaptation so much in the show. I think this, both this chapter and the next chapter, are just like triumphs of adaptation in the show. They're just so good, and they're different, you know, but they're really good.
That's very true. It's hard to that's just true. They really did do a good job with this and the next chapter.
Yeah. It's really well described in the books how his eyes roll out of his face, though. That's not something I'm going to forget like anytime soon. Like thinking about the mountain and viper fight, like that's that level of brutality as seen on the show that I almost don't even want to read, because I'm sure it's going to be even worse written down. Just like Krasnus, the melting of Krasnus's face.
Can I go ahead and tell you, it is not worse.
It's not worse.
watching it on the show was the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, I think they took a few liberties here or there with the show.
Okay, so they actually overdid it for this. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
This is very, though, Krasnus's face, like I'm not going to even... trying to picture it is terrifying. You just
come
over
read
the,
it for the listeners.
Yeah, okay. Please.
A lance of swirling dark flame took Krasnus full in the face. His eyes melted and ran down his cheeks, and the oil in his hair and beard burst so fiercely into fire that for an instant the slaver wore a burning crown twice as tall as his head. The sudden stench of charred meat overwhelmed even his perfume, and his wails seemed to drown out all other sound. Then the next sentence, which I love so much, it says, "Then the plaza of punishment blew apart into blood and chaos."
Oh, yeah.
Love it. I mean, in this next paragraph is full of really great imagery of what's happening and how it's happening so quickly. It's just so cool. You guys should read this if you're not reading along with this. I know a lot of you are, well done. Well done.
It's a larger symbol too, because when we first enter this area, we get a great description of this plaza of punishment, and it's also the first thing anybody really sees upon entering Astapor. So to have it completely obliterated is symbolic. You know, she's not only freeing these slaves, but she's destroying this area, which is so representative of everything that this city stands for.
Well, that and the punishment now is just going to the masters instead of the slaves. Yeah. No, and I mean, they had, like Zach mentioned the descriptions, like they had a guy who's like, people who had been flayed, and a guy whose arm was, you know, from fingertips to elbows just covered in bugs because of what they had done to him. He raised a hand against the master, and the hand was flayed off or taken, and the rest of him may or may not be alive. Like, terrifying stuff, but she is dishing it out. Like, all this karma that has enveloped this city is just being thrown right back at them, and that makes for a really cool Dany chapter.
Freedom!
Very good Dany chapter.
I was excited.
Can we talk about Sansa?
We should. We should talk about Sansa.
Do we have to?
I love this chapter.
Yikes! This chapter is terrific.
I didn't see the marriage coming like this. I felt like I was as surprised as Sansa in this moment.
Micah, and Nora Snow is not going to be very happy with this.
She
knows we're just having a little bit of fun.
This chapter starts with description of the dress that Sansa was getting fitted for in the last Sansa chapter that we had, and she is so excited. The first few paragraphs of this chapter are a beautiful description of a gorgeous gray dress with like a neckline that goes down to her belly button and is covered tastefully in lace. It's like a very sexy womanly dress with a really tight corset in it. And Sansa feels so hot, and she still doesn't quite figure out, like, huge skirts, and she's got new shoes and everything. She's like, wow, the queen is so nice. And the queen's just like, what, the standing there watching her get dressed. And Sansa still doesn't figure it out until, even when she says, like, she realizes she's getting married. And the queen was like, it's a shame we're going to have to give you that gargoyle or cripple or whatever. And and she's like, well, Willis isn't that crippled. I don't know if I would call him a gargoyle.
Is a little harsh. I don't know.
Yeah. And she's still, until she hears it, she's still not quite there. She's still living in this fantasy world. And this might be, of all of the things that have happened to Sansa, clearly she's still dreaming about marrying her lord and living a fancy life with puppies and hawks and things like
and
that.
Sons and sons named after her brothers.
Yeah.
Hawking.
She has, in this chapter, she may transform into like her final form. This might be where it happens, because I think this is where all of her dreams go to die. This is all she had left in her mind, was the idea of at least marrying a nice young man who may grow to love her and be gallant and handsome, because clearly she's not going to get any of the rest of what she wanted, because as far as she knows, her whole family's dead.
Right.
Or traitorous.
Or soon to be dead.
Yeah. And so, like, all she has left is, like, maybe I can go join another family and live out my life and be happy. And now they're wedding her to the most hideous person in the Seven Kingdoms, and the uncle of this monster who's terrorized her for the last year of her life, probably, in King's Landing. And to her, the worst thing that could happen. And it is, we know, I think, as readers who are all big fans of Tyrion, we've seen inside his head, we know what kind of bullshit he puts up with. And what a good guy he is on the inside. So we don't feel that dread. And so it's easy for us to read this Sansa chapter and see her disdain for Tyrion and feel a little resentful of her, I think. I certainly do.
Resentful?
Yeah, because I just want to be like, he's a really good person. He's a cool, he's probably.
This could have been worse.
She reaches that decision. Like, she figures kind of like during, at one point during dinner, I think she, or maybe it's during the wedding, when she turns around and sees the look on his face, she felt bad for not kneeling. You know, like, I feel like she knows that it could be worse.
The refusing to kneel part, I was just like, even in the show, watching that,
it was a little harsh. I think you're right, though. She's coming into her final form. Like, what's that? Sansa Chu is evolving. Like, she's becoming who she's going to be. I just think that what the interesting force at play here about this whole chapter is that it's a sudden development to her. But Tyrion has obviously known for some time, and he says that he wanted to tell her sooner, a little later on. But for her and for the Tyrells,
and for me and us
and Zach and me, it has to be a secret. Like, still, and the Tyrells, I get the impression, going a little bit ahead, but I get the impression that they weren't even notified until after it happened. Like, they show up grudgingly at the feast, and there are just, like, they have this look of defeat. There's no witty liners, one-liners or two-liners even, from the Queen of Thorns. They don't talk to Sansa, you know, because they've been defeated. The Lannister, Tywin, has implanted, you know, his family in the middle of this plot, and it's a deft move from him, but they had to keep it secret, and Sansa would have surely told the Tyrells, and they probably would have gotten her out, you know, of the city or tried to before, if anybody knew.
It's possible that they feel defeated. I think it's probably more just a setback for them. This is not the end game for the Tyrells. Getting Sansa married into their family was just a power move. And they are the Lannisters with flowers, as Ser Dantos said. It's all the same kind of manipulation. And one way or another, Sansa is a piece in this chess game to these people. So it's not a defeat, because it wasn't their end game. It's a bummer. But I think the saddest thing is that none of them even look at her or talk to her. It's either that they feel so guilty that they couldn't have prevented this, or that she does not mean anything to them anymore. No, she is cold. No longer useful.
That is cold.
Yeah. And I do think the Tyrells are a family that they have a lot of redeemable characters in it. I love me the Queen of Thorns. I love her to pieces. And Marjorie seems very nice. But ultimately, we never get a point of view chapter from these people, so we don't know what's going on in their head. I know I say that a lot. Like, I have my doubts about people's motivations, because anybody could kill anyone else at any point. It just might happen. And Elena, we have posited, was the one of the people who masterminded Joffrey being assassinated. So we know that she's got some good character qualities, at least. But I do wonder if they are just refusing to make eye contact or speak to Sansa because she can't help them anymore.
That's curious. I mean, it all happened so quickly, even for us reading the chapter. I mean, I thought this was going to be another Sansa chapter where, okay, maybe there's developments with the dress, et cetera. I know that we...
it's like...
You know?
Reading the second pair, you're like, this chapter is going to be all about the dress.
Or something.
Yeah.
I know that we learned about the fact that Tyrion is to be wed to Sansa not too long ago in that mm-hmm. excellent chapter when they were inside of the Small Council. But yeah. I certainly didn't expect this to be expedited like it was. And for Sansa to go from what she understands as a really nice fitting to have her cloak of her house colors and the direwolf thrown over her shoulders, like immediately essentially being whisked away from what she thought, again, was a fitting right to the wedding. Everyone is there. They're already waiting. It's a small mm-hmm. wedding because this is, again, kind of a secretive situation. Tyrion is there, resplendently dressed. Joffrey is there. The king is there waiting. You know, she's been thrust into this much like us, and I was taken aback by how quick it happened. And mm-hmm. it was just, they were unprepared in so many different ways. Like, for example, not having a stool for Tyrion to don her cloak of protection.
I mean, even if they would have thought about it, I don't think they would have given him one.
I don't think so either. I think they wanted to humiliate him.
Well, they certainly did. And for me, it was one of the most just hardened lines that came out of this chapter and possibly the book so far. It says, and so it was that her lord husband cloaked her in the colors of House Lannister whilst standing on the back of a fool.
Yeah. And it's that's so a, it, like when you know, you feel for Tyrion because you know him, right? Like if we didn't get any perspective chapters on Tyrion, he would just be this conniving gargoyle kind of character, because that's how we would see him from other people's point of view. Sansa and Cersei, to some extent, we would only see this ugly little monster. But he's such a good guy. And of all the people at King's Landing that Sansa could want to marry or even not want to marry, Tyrion is probably the best choice.
And she even says that he's not as bad as the rest of them.
Yeah.
I think she meant the Lannisters in that case, but I mean everybody. Like, I mean everybody at King's Landing.
Everyone.
Of all of the people at King's Landing, Tyrion is the only one I can think of who wouldn't have any interest in using her. You know?
Certainly, like the most eligible bachelor, or the most like the highest prize to win.
In my estimation,
the king before. So
yeah, I mean, he's fallen somewhat, and he's not a cool dude to look at. Like, he looks rough. He's not Peter Dinklage. I'm sorry, Peter Dinklage.
Yeah, no,
but
he
you
isn't,
are a handsome motherfucker. But like this guy has no. He is. I will just, like, as a sidebar, when Peter Dinklage was cast as Tyrion Lannister, I was like, I get it, and I'm excited, but that guy is way too handsome. They are going to have to ugly him up. And even when he, like, loses his nose in the Battle of Blackwater Bay, he's still really handsome. He just has a really cool scar.
He didn't
now.
Really lose his nose.
No, he did. Well, he does.
Just made
he does
more
in the
rugged.
Book.
Yeah, in the book, his nose is a scab. Like, that's what it is stated.
There
in
are people who've done very good Photoshops of Peter Dinklage to make him look like what he should look like in the book, and it's horrifying.
It
but
is?
I recommend Googling it. It's pretty
gosh,
awful.
It must, like, be weird to be him and just, like, Google yourself one day and come up with, like,
I just don't see, I don't think Peter Dinklage is sitting around Googling himself.
Yeah, he's like, he goes, he's got Lannister some other real injuries.
I don't know. It's weird to think that there's a photo of you floating around with no nose somewhere. I don't know.
Real injuries.
It's like, well, how do you think Ralph Fiennes feels, man? Yourself?
Yeah, think it's like you're Ralph Fiennes or something.
Anyway, knowing what I know about Tyrion, I would marry Tyrion Lannister. It sounds like he has the best intentions. He's well born. He's very funny. And it sounds like he's got a great boner. We see it.
On the next episode of Game of Bones, Kate marries.
Actually, she says it's ugly, but
Okay, but it's the first boner she's seen. Let's take it back a second. Boners are weird looking in general. If you've never seen one and you see one, especially one that's like veiny and big, it's going to look horrifying.
It's like, oh
right?
my God.
The first time you see a giant boner, you'd be like, ah! You don't want that anywhere near you. But once you've gotten over the initial shock of it, right. It's a cool situation.
Kate, I had to go through that recently. You know what? That's too dirty for this.
Strike.
Let's talk about this dress.
Let's
talk about this dress. This is the second paragraph. I did want to quote this because it's just such good description. It's basically fashion porn. Like it is just well written. I'm skipping a little bit, but it starts, my reading starts with, "The small clothes were all in silk, but the gown itself was ivory, samite, and cloth of silver, and lined with silvery satin. The points of the long, dagged sleeves almost touched the ground when she lowered her arms, and it was a woman's gown, not a little girl's, there was no doubt of that. The bodice was slashed in front, almost to her belly, the deep V covered over with a panel of ornate mirish lace in dove gray. The skirts were long and full, the waist so tight that Sansa had to hold her breath as they laced her into it. They brought her new shoes as well, slippers of soft gray doe skin that hugged her feet like lovers. 'You are beautiful, my lady,' the seamstress said when she was dressed." I mean, the slippers hugged her feet like lovers. Let's just marinate on that.
Okay.
Doe skin. Bambi's mother died to make Sansa's slippers.
It sounds awesome. They sound
like good slippers.
They sound like I don't know if they put her in like heels or if these are flat. I hope they were flats. God help her. She doesn't need to be any taller than she is, especially if she's marrying Tyrion Lannister. But they sound like nice leather, like soft leather that's perfectly fitted to her little feet. Oh, it sounds so good. That was like my I just like reveled in almost like the ASMR. Feeling that I got from thinking about soft, supple doe skin slippers. It's like,
I want some doe skin slippers.
Me too.
Maybe
not buck really.
Skin, just to be a little bit more manly.
What would happen if I wore those to work?
I think you'd be promoted, sir.
All right. So I'm going to try that out.
Yeah, they're the slippers of champions.
They're like, oh, goodness, Micah. Those are some very nice slippers.
Clearly, we're paying you too much.
During parts of this chapter, it reminded me a lot of going back to the beginning of A Game of Thrones when Daenerys was sold, for lack of a better word, to Khal Drogo. It seems like Sansa, in a way, is being sold by the Lannisters to one of their own family members. It's completely against her will, right? Just like Dany. And interesting that we come from a Dany chapter into this Sansa chapter, where Dany has sort of become this freer of those who have been enslaved. And I wonder if later on, you know, we'll get to a Sansa chapter where she sort of breaks away and comes into her own. But she's very much in a similar situation to Daenerys. And I don't know if you guys agree or disagree with that, but it's just something that came to mind.
And Cersei, who Sansa has always, maybe not looked up to, but who has been a caretaker, caregiver, kind of overseeing everything, including this dress fitting, says this to Sansa in this chapter. It's actually maybe 10 paragraphs. And she says, "You're prettier with your mouth closed, Sansa." And it's this admonishment that's so... well, not forwarding her sex, to be honest, but it's just so evil. And the fact that Sansa is put upon, not just for this wedding, but the bedding that follows after, all in the span of this chapter, it, you know, speaks to the quicker pace that you were just talking about it having.
And part of why I don't like how Sansa acts in this chapter is because Tyrion saves her a number of times, and one of which you just mentioned, which was the bedding. I mean, she was about to have her clothes ripped off in front of everybody, which, you know, it happened in front of a much smaller group of people previously. But even in that situation, it was Tyrion who saved her.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a moment earlier on in this chapter where she's talking with Joffrey, and it's Tyrion who steps in and really saves her there. And at the end of the chapter, in a way, it's Tyrion who saves her again because he chooses not to force himself upon her.
Yeah. And I don't even think that it would have been a forcing situation. She didn't want to have sex with him, but they were married and she was willing, I think, to do it. She was just like not going to be into it. And he wants her to be into it. He knows that that's really important to her. And so he's like, I am supposed to do this. And this is what marriage is all about. And I know, like, she's just like laying there. She's like, fine, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. It's just fucking terrifying. He's like, no, I want to wait however long it's going to take you before you actually want me. And then she says maybe the worst, most heartbreaking thing mm-hmm. about this whole chapter. She's like, what if I never want it? And he's like, yeesh. Yeah.
He recoils as if slapped.
Well, I guess if you never want it, you never want it. Like it's so hard for Tyrion to realize that it's just as hard for him. He's married to someone who doesn't want him. He wants her physically, but he doesn't want her to not want him. And so they're both in this relationship where they're stuck. They're like imprisoned already on their wedding night. And it just feels like such a punishment for both of them.
Yeah, I guess it sets the tone for the rest of the marriage. If you're talking about, you know, feeling trapped, they both come away from that feeling terrible.
Yeah.
I thought Sansa had such a great point that honestly says a lot about not only the sexuality between these two, but just in general. It was really interesting to me. She says, he is as frightened as I am, Sansa realized. Perhaps that should have made her feel more kindly toward him, but it did not. All she felt was pity, and pity was death to desire. He was looking at her, waiting for her to say something, but all her words had withered. She could only stand there trembling. So in this case, pity being the death to desire, do these people have any kind of future with each other? With both, I mean, both sides of this situation are filled with pity for one another's charge. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't bode well.
I know.
No, but she's only 13, as he points out. And I think that's in part the reason why he decides to give it some time to not make this an even more uncomfortable situation than it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the transition into this scene with these two was a bit more manageable than how it was in the show. Joffrey and Tyrion had their sort of stare down for a moment, and everyone did well to kind of like chill it out. Like Tywin was part of it, and he was like, hey, my son's drunk, your grace, and it's fine. And I feel like Tyrion kind of like realized what he did and jumped back a bit too, you know, kind of being self-deprecating and turning it into a humorous manner. But, you know, they were lucky to have transitioned into their bedchambers as they did. I mean, he probably would have been part of a legit bedding ceremony, the carrying off and tearing off the clothes of each other on the arms of people, which is kind of terrifying to me if you really think about it. A girl of 13 being carried by a bunch of sweaty, drunk, grown men and having, you know, nasty things being shouted at them.
Yeah.
That's a bit harsh. So, you know, Tyrion stole her away from the situation. And I feel like, man, for how scared she is of what's going on, he really made this whole process a lot less painful for her.
She's lucky. She doesn't realize it. She doesn't know Tyrion, and she's still quite superficial in a lot of ways, so she doesn't realize it, but she's lucky to have him on her side.
Yeah. I feel like their political alliance, the fact that they're married, may come back later. We know she gets spirited away from King's Landing quite quickly, but I like that even though they may become separated, their marriage is still something that could affect things politically.
It might. You know, what I found interesting was when she was getting passed around from one person to another in the little dance sequence.
In the dance. Mm-hmm.
And Sir Garland, right, points out, your imp will make a better husband, when he's talking about Sir Loras.
Yes.
He's a bigger man than he seems, I think.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a nice...
amazingly high praise.
Tip of the cap. Absolutely. Yeah. To a Lannister, which clearly the Tyrells are not big fans of, but to have somebody like that talk so high about Tyrion, I don't just think he's saying it because Sansa's there. I think he's saying it because he might actually believe it.
I think so too. And also he knows that Loras is just gay as hell. And so
queer is a $3 bill.
and so Sansa would never be happy married to him.
Like, I know something you don't know about Loras still.
There's also another line a little bit further down, which Kate, I think, may apply to some of the things we've been talking about on and off. And it was about King Aegon. And Joffrey brings it up when he's talking to Sansa about how basically anytime he wants her, he can have her. And he says that King Aegon, he had any woman he wanted, whether they were married or not.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But guys, okay, I know where you're going with this, but was it the third Aegon or the fourth Aegon? We're not sure, right?
Maybe I think it's the promiscuous one.
The crazy one. Yeah, okay, the one that everybody hates.
All right.
So we don't need to get into it. We don't have time.
No, we don't need to get into that. But I just thought it's there. It's in the boiler episode, right?
If we're talking about, going to have one of those.
If we're talking about what's in the text, like Tyrion's line, you'd be fucking your bride with a wooden cook. You know, is different in the book. He actually utters the words, "I will geld you, I swear."
Yep.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I'm like, whoa, he is way pissed off. Like, he totally should be, but still, it's just, it's intense to actually read the words, "I will geld you, I swear."
Yeah, and he's doing it in protection of Sansa again. You know, like, he's drunk, and he's mad, and he knows that his new bride cannot even stand to look at him. And so he lashes out a little bit, but it's in defense of this girl that he sort of inexplicably wants to protect and make sure that she feels safe with him. And I'm very grateful for Tyrion Lannister, just like Tyrion Lannister Appreciation Club all around.
Right. I think, though, Tyrion also needs to remember that his nephew is how old? So despite the fact that he is the king and he is a prick, you know, he's also a teenager, so
yeah, but Tyrion should act a little bit more mature. See, so much terrible shit.
Joffrey would act on everything he jokes about acting on.
Yeah, like it's not like he's making these jokes and they're like tasteless and everybody's uncomfortable. Like, he has physically abused Sansa extensively, and I don't think he did the crossbow shit in the book, but
no,
show Joffrey certainly does a lot of insane crap. So I think he's justified.
He gropes her during the wedding
ceremony.
He gropes her. Yeah. And then he tells her that he can fuck her whenever he wants. Like, what an asshole.
It's terrifying.
What a total douchebag.
So that insult to the king's royal person is just,
"You threatened to kill me."
I love it. And he's such like an insolent little brat too. Like, he's, when Tyrion tells him, like, "I will geld you," if Joffrey, he's such a shit. He just turns into a child immediately. He starts like shrieking at the top of his lungs, like tattletale style. And I'm just like, he's this mixture, this horrifying, horrifying little person. I hate him so much. I hate Joffrey.
The adaptation is perfect. It's so, the show is great. And it has a different ending line as well. You know, of course, we all loved watching Peter Dinklage say, "And now my watch begins," or "And so my watch begins." It's, you know, I wanted to talk about this ending line in the book because it's kind of darker. He says instead, "Why? That is why the gods made whores for imps like me." When she says, "What if I never want you?" And that is kind of like a dejected, "Well, I'll go lay with whores." He's not, I don't think he's thinking specifically of Shay, even though he has Shay, who happens to be a whore. But I think he's just like that. He's defeated. Like, I think that really, he recoiled as if being slapped. I feel like he really is considering that she might never want him.
He's used to being treated as less.
Totally.
And not considered equal as everyone else.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's sad, but he considers this to be a sexual rejection from her, and he won't force the issue. He's not going to be like, "Well, we have to at least get you pregnant, and then I can go have sex with whoever." Like, he's not even going to do that. And he must be aware that not bedding Sansa means their marriage isn't consummated. So there's a legal ramification to the fact that he is not forcing the issue.
But he says, "Father be damned, you know, my father be damned." And it's just like, that's really big of him. That's really...
He's a big guy.
So what are we thinking about Owens?
I would like to give my own for the Dany chapter to Dany.
Okay.
And I know, Eric, I know about your principles.
Thank you.
But I choose to ignore them because frankly, Daenerys kind of, I feel like she should collect Auxiliary owns for the chapters around her for this chapter. Like she, for the previous okay. Dawn chapter, I think I want to give my own retroactively to Daenerys for what she was about to do.
Kate, you're like the people who tweet in who haven't read and are just like, I'm going to give an own to the seasons weather. Because the weather's already like fucked up anyway. You're like, I'm going to give the own to Dany because she's about to burn somebody's face off. Then after it happens, you're like,
I'm going to give the own to Dany because she just burned somebody's face off two chapters ago. Exactly. No, Daenerys is the epitome of the word own in this chapter. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give my own to Daenerys as well for smacking him in the face with the fingers of the harpy. The harpy. Yeah. That was a good boss move.
Who knew? I wouldn't be able to control a whip that, you know, with that precision.
Oh, I think so. They're not too long. It's kind of a small. I'd say that the strips of leather are probably like 13 inches max. You could handle that.
You know, I feel like I did try and throw a whip once, and like I hit myself in the face or in the body, and it hurt.
Damn,
it was
dude.
Not. It's it was one. Of, it was like a. I don't want to say it was blunt, but and I forget where it is either at like a zoo or something. But yeah, like I held a whip. It was at like a Renaissance fair.
You were whipping like animals.
No. Whip. I've held a whip before, and I thought it was cool because Indiana Jones does it in the
Last Crusade. Oh, yeah. Right.
And so I tried and I hurt myself. It was like my lip or my arm, and it hurt. So like, yeah, you're right. Like if there's one chapter where the point of view character should get a note, it's probably this one.
I don't mean to be insensitive because you guys were like cringing when Eric said he hit himself in the face with a whip, but I would pay money to see that.
I think I would.
I guess we found our $10 tier at the
There you go.
One time I busted a blood vessel in Eric's hand when we were sword fighting.
Oh, that actually really hurt. I forgot about that. It's fortunately didn't scar, but I thought it would.
I told you, man. I was like, you want to step in the ring? You better be ready.
I know. I was not prepared. You actually, Zach has bested me in physical combat of all sorts. He absolutely, I'm not ashamed to admit it because I'm actually just enamored, like, and shocked, like, how much ass of mine he has kicked. Like,
hey, man.
Hotel room Quidditch, foam swords in a living room. Like, unbelievable.
Oh wow!
All your normal sport.
Can I have your own then?
Yeah. Oh no! I have my own. I gotta give my own to someone else. I'm giving my own to. Micah should go. No, right, okay. That was. I guess that's as fine a transition.
My own goes to Dany.
Okay.
What for?
Now
she has the line. Why do the gods make kings and queens if not to protect the ones who can't protect themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the point of leading?
Well, I
now follow that up.
Now even more resolutely do not want to give my own to the title. I can't if you three did. I am actually going to give my own. I took a picture of it. I'm going to give my own to the lovers. You guys may remember or know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Giving my own to these lovers. So Dany is there's at one point the river, which is called the Worm. She's looking across it and there's different wooded islands. And on one of them, children are playing. And on another, there are these two lovers. And I'm going to read the quote here. She does make sort of a very humanitarian, philosophical observation. But I think it's actually George. So that's why it doesn't go to Dany. but here's the quote. On another island, two lovers kissed in the shade of tall green trees with no more shame than Dothraki at a wedding. Without clothing, she could not tell if they were slave or free. Now, that's George saying that without clothes, she couldn't infer, but he's actually making a statement, or you could infer it to mean that it's a statement, which is that we're all, when naked, we're stripped of all of our, like, we're the same people if we're not.
And this is the same chapter where the fringes are dictating social status, but at the end of the day, we're all just equal.
We're all just equal when you get down to the bare bones nakedness of it all. So I thought that was really profound. So own to George R. R. Martin for that.
Well, very when cool. you put it like that, all of our owns go to George R. R. Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice try,
if you
Eric.
Look at the quote, it's not Dany saying in internal monologue or otherwise that she can't tell if they're free. George
well,
is
a perspective chapter. Everything that's
yeah, but
wrote
this
it.
Is a chapter. In this her, is a chapter where mind. he actually keeps things from the reader too. So, I don't know, it's a weird machination.
Okay. Well, my own for the Sansa chapter goes to the ever-graceful dancing floor machine that is Tywin Lannister.
Dancing floor machine.
Yeah, right? Unsmiling What was the phrase used?
Grace. Unsmiling grace.
Unsmiling grace.
Smooth unsmiling.
Smooth unsmiling grace.
Listen, he's had experience. He's like, I'm about to cut the rug on this shit. Like, bring it.
He's just performed so many of these functions, like, as representative to the Lannister family that he's over it.
It's not like, how gone. Many times are these kids going to get married? my own for the Sansa chapter goes to Sir Osmond Kettleblack.
Mm.
Who, when escorting Sansa from her chambers, says to her, "Do as you're told, sweetling. It won't be so bad. Wolves are supposed to be brave, aren't they?" And she's like, "Yeah, yeah." And it's this total transformation moment for her. She's like, "Oh shit, yeah, okay, you're right, you're right." And I like Sir Osmond Kettleblack is kind of a tool for the most part, but he redeemed himself a little bit with that. So, own to you, Sir Osmond.
Nicely done. I'm going to have to give my own to Willis Tyrell for being nice to Sir Garlan, being the person to strike with the first nickname, which was not Garlan the Greensick, Garlan the Gailing, Garlan the Gargoyle, or Garlan the or Garth the Gross. I feel like it was nice. So he's called Garlan the Gallant, and Sansa is like, "Oh, you are gallant," because he comes up to her at the table and he's like, "Oh, may I have this dance if your new husband doesn't mind?" And he's like, she can dance with whoever she wants. Go on ahead. And it was just cool. Like Sansa, even in all of that moment, was like, "You are smooth, Garland the Gallant."
Yeah. So like Willis like gave him that title and then he chose to live up to it.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
What's in a name?
What is in a name? And finally, I'm going to give my own for this chapter to Sansa.
What?
You just gave us all shit for giving the own for the Dany chapter to Dany, and now you're giving the own for the Sansa chapter to Sansa.
That revelation to be accompanied by much laughter, and maybe one of our listeners has taken the time to humor me by laughing, but you know, when Sansa refuses to kneel for Tyrion, it causes such mixed feelings in the readership of, you know, I feel mixed feelings even in myself. We want to hate Sansa for doing this. We feel immediately sad for Tyrion, who has to tug not once, not twice, but even three times, and she still does not kneel. But this is the death of her fantasy that we talked about at the beginning of our Sansa discussion, was that this is the moment where she has to let go of her vision. And she is basically resolutely remaining standing and saying, "I will not kneel for my husband to put his protection over me. I won't do it. I'm going to be standing and my height will be sufficient and he will be tall and handsome, or at least tall enough to wrap protection." So they have to find, obviously, this other solution, which ends up being Ser Dantos, but she does not. She will not and does not kneel. And even though she feels bad about it afterwards, I think that that very last grasp that she was holding on to that dream is unworthy, because why should she have to kneel to receive her husband's protection? He clearly can't protect her if he can't drape, you know, something over her if he's not her height. That's the, you know, theory.
Mm-hmm. So. For all the sensitivity and sympathy and protection that Tyrion does show Sansa, I feel that that move from her is just full on brat. And I do believe she deserves some owns for this chapter, so I'm not disagreeing with you. But I think that moment in and of itself, I totally disagree. I think that's the least own-worthy moment.
You're disagreeing with an own?
Yeah. Well,
no, I mean, you can say that she owns Tyrion, right?
Oh, yeah, but I don't really mean to say that.
But she does. I agree with Kate.
That's what she's doing.
She's acting like a 13-year-old. And she's upset with everything that's going on. She's upset at Cersei. She is upset pretty much with every Lannister, probably aside from Tyrion, and he's the only person really in that family that is on her side, so to speak, and she can't even do him the courtesy of kneeling down.
Exactly.
Why should I spare his feelings when no one cares about mine?
Wah.
It is such a little girl
thing.
Such
a bratty move.
Yeah. But it's her last time that she'll ever get to do something like that, so hey. It's her wedding day. It's her wedding. She can crash.
Oh, yeah, because
she's Bridezilla.
I'm with her, though. I'm with Sansa because, I mean, she was just having a normal day, and then all of a sudden she's being whisked into a seriously getting married.
They knew the height restrictions. They should, you know, prepare a stool. It's customary to have the...
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I still think it was kind of funny that Dantos, like, he stood on Dantos. It's like, turn into a table. It's like all the old stuff that I had to do as a kid with my friends. So, not too bad. I've done it before. It's not that big of a deal. Oh, geez. Well, those are our owns, ladies and gentlemen. I think that now, between the four of us, on our 250th episode, it's time to see what you thought in the world about this stuff.
Let's do.
So for our owns this week, let's start off with an email.
Mm. Ooh. Ooh.
From our good friend, Nick Hartley, who does not so.
He does not.
He says, my own for Daenerys goes to Drogon, Viserion, and Rhaegal. Whether you're from Karth or Astapor, rich or poor, slave or slaver, you are amazed. The birth of Dany's children has brought wonder back into the world. Even the people of Astapor, whose depravity goes so far as watching children be devoured by bears for entertainment, stop and hope for just a single glance.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
My own for Sansa goes to Ser Dantos. He not only gives solid counsel about marital alliances well before they come to pass, he also makes a hell of a step stool.
Yeah,
that's true.
Nick Hartley does not so.
Best signature to an email ever.
Why not Facebook, right?
Yeah. Those of you who have scrolled upon our wall recently, giving your owns for the Dany and Sansa chapters. Let's start here with Lonnie Anzavino, who says, Dany incomparably owned all with a solid assist from Drogon.
Dracarys.
Also, they say, hard to pick an own for the Sansa chapter. There were a lot of contenders, but I'm ultimately giving my own to Tyrion for refusing to do Tywin's bidding, while at the same time owning and controlling his own lust. That's true. It's probably the first time Tyrion has turned down sex, but it marks a certain maturity and ownage of his own destiny. Oh, that was a missed opportunity to give Tyrion the own during a Sansa chapter, because I wouldn't give it to him during a Tyrion chapter. Even though I gave Sansa the own. Missed opportunity. Sorry.
Auxiliary owned a Tyrion.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Lonnie, for that.
Jen Wyman writes, she says, Dany owned the slavers. Really no other own is acceptable here. And for Sansa, she says, own goes to Sansa's inner monologue. I am a Stark. Yes, I can be brave.
I'm also a Gryffindor.
Different sigils, but...
Oh, true.
Different series.
Yeah, that too.
Well, I guess she is wearing a lion at that point.
A Gryffindor always pays his debts.
There you go.
We got some Twitter owns as well.
Twons.
Hoyson Doyle has two owns. He says, my own for the Dany chapter goes to Drogon for going all Raiders of the Lost Ark on the slaver's face, eyes, and beard.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
And Sansa own is for Ser Kettleblack. And the quote, do as you're told, sweetling. It won't be so bad. Wolves are supposed to be brave, aren't they? Yes.
I feel like Ser Kettleblack needs to have a talk with Strike about certain things that we'll discuss in our other show.
Indeed.
Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
You're right.
The Lady Ash writes in, she says, own goes to Dany for knowing a queen should protect her people. Very true.
Indeed.
Very true.
Nicholas Eng says, my own goes to Dany for finally breaking out of the Khaleesi shadow and reminding the slavers of old Valyria.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
With that diction and that sharp tongue. Mm-hmm.
Well, Alexander Murphy writes in, my own goes to a highborn maid of 10 and 3 with a fair face and auburn hair. Has anyone seen her?
Yes. Certainly have.
Kate Appleby says, Mother Kate. She says, her own's for Dany.
What does Kate say, Kate?
Kate says, for the Dany chapter, quote, the oil in his hair and beard burst so fiercely into fire that for an instant the slaver wore a burning crown. Much like Viserys was killed by a crown, so was Krasnus. An interesting parallel.
Man.
Death by crown for everybody in Dany's story plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh, I wonder if that's a metaphor for something.
Next one is from Ram Dent, who says, first own goes to Dany for being a total baller and killing the slavers.
Mm-hmm.
Obvious. Yeah, but that was just so awesome.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Second own goes to Surfy.
Surfy
Turners.
Okay. Railer Blades is one tweet, but now we need Surfy Turner.
Oh, God. Photoshop Sophie Turner a on a surfboard.
Somebody do that for us, and we will do it.
Yes, so Ram's second own goes to Sophie Turner for making Sansa much more sympathetic in the show than in the book.
You just need to put a face. You need to see that loss in her eyes before you can ever forgive her not kneeling. Or what? Actually, I think she kneels in the show, doesn't she?
Kneel!
I think she eventually does, but it's still really awkward.
They captured it well, though, in the show, the awkwardness of it.
Yeah.
I was pretty impressed. Nicole writes in. She says, Own goes to Krasnys for wearing so much oil and perfume, he became a fire hazard. Drogon sends his regards.
Yeah.
We all know those people. And she goes on to say, I think Eric's quote, if you knew him, you'd like him, about Tyrion is relevant here. I wish Sansa had got to know him.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, she will. Not she will, but there's still time.
There's time.
We also got in some other ownage, just generic owns. One that I really liked here from Brittany Black, who says, Kate's summary of porny shit and boner trouble had her laughing uncontrollably. Wait for this, Kate. She was laughing uncontrollably in a break room behind Diagon Alley.
Yes!
Nice! Nice!
And a guy from Weasley's Wizard Wheezes was staring at her.
I love life. You know?
It's so cool that people we know work at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. That's cool.
Think about that, though. Like, the fact that someone is listening to Kate talking about porny shit in our show in Diagon Alley, and then like she's like maybe laughing awkwardly, and then there's a guy that's in Weasley's Wizard Wheezes like looking at her. This is happening in our lives right now. I love life.
Brittany Black is killing it on Twitter.
Killing it. Absolutely.
Own Twitter on to Brittany Black. Thanks, Brittany.
Oh, nice. Well, we heard earlier from Nicholas Hartley, who gave us his own. But actually now he has a story he shared with us via our email inbox, regarding Thanksgiving. And we did ask for, I guess, over social, who would be your favorite, or was it on last week's episode?
Micah posed the question.
Yeah, Micah posed the question on last week's episode. Who would you most like to eat Thanksgiving dinner with? Nick Hartley wrote in and said, I'm going to submit two lists for characters to eat with on Thanksgiving. For purely reasons based on the meal itself, you will have to go with hot pie and Tyrion.
You cannot give up on the gravy.
Not sure how much hot pie brings to the table conversation-wise, but I could be certain that we'd have good food and fine wine. My second list is for my two favorite... Oh, okay, I see what it is here. My two favorite POVs in the whole series, Davos Seaworth and Victarion Greyjoy. Having grown up in Rhode Island, I'm sure we can talk about our love of the sea. Perhaps after dinner, they can show me how to tie some knots or how to rig a sail properly.
Yeah, hard truths, Nick.
I hope the four of you have a very happy Thanksgiving filled with food, drink, and loved ones. Nick Hartley, just not so. You know,
very sweet of you, Nick.
Nick, that is very... Now, I do not know who Victarion Greyjoy is, but we know he's a Greyjoy, or she, he or she. Is it a he or she? Can we spoil that?
Not telling you.
I don't know. Okay. Whoever like it is, they're a Greyjoy, so they know not. You know, I've wanted to learn knots. Knots is like a good like self-betterment thing. Just teach you, learn yourself.
Education in general, you know?
Yeah. Like, that's cool to have that aspiration to want to know knots. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Nick. That was very nice. We got a tweet from Amanda McGowan who says, here's a pic of nearly all my favorite Game of Thrones characters.
It's a cemetery.
It's a graveyard. Not too bad.
Brittany Black also sent us a picture on Twitter of her new Christmas ornaments, which are awesome. They're all Game of Thrones sigil Christmas ornaments. So thank you. That's amazing. I need to get some of those.
I have two new ornaments to put on my tree, my Christmas tree. I have the one red ornament because I have the Charlie Brown Christmas tree. I have a Game of Owns ornament that a listener friend sent us. I know, Eric, you have some as well.
Yes.
Me too.
Kate, we need to get you a Game of Owns ornament because they're pretty cool looking.
Yeah. I didn't until Eric sent us one like on November 3rd and said Merry Christmas. I was like, where did this come from?
I took it out of the box because we were setting up our tree early because I won't be home. Or I'm going to be home for Christmas, so I won't be here. So we set up our tree early. But yeah, I saw that picture and I had to send it to you guys. Sorry I said Merry Christmas and not Happy November 3rd.
Or Happy Hanukkah.
It was like a faux pas.
Just to wrap things up here, hearing from all of our listeners out there, we did get a real fun back and forth between some commenters on Watchers on the Wall. And they're from our good friends, Dollar Sned. and Lollius Palicanus. Is that right? Zach, will you play the part of Lollius?
Oh, I would love to, actually.
Well, as you know, we talk a lot about pronunciation sometimes on this show, and we made fun of Roller's name, Roller, Reeler, Ragu, whatever you want to call him, or her for that matter, on the last episode. And Dollars Ned started out in the comments by saying that his name is actually Arlor. He's a pirate.
And last week, Polycanus says Rulor or Urlor, being serious. And then he goes, so we got Arlor, he's a pirate from Dollars Ned. And then Lollius writes back, Azor Ahar! And then they start arguing about how it's actually pronounced. We don't know how it's actually pronounced, so thank you
all
for
right.
that.
So thank you to all the commenters over there at Watchers. We love reading through and commenting ourselves from time to time. And as I'm sure you are all well aware, there's many different ways that you can get in touch with the show. And we've read from all of them, I think. Twitter, Facebook, and through email. Twitter and Facebook is just Game of Owns. We keep it pretty simple there. But the email is contact@gameofowns.com.
Through a little wrench in your... In the little setup
yeah,
there.
We could have just done Game of Owns at theinternet.com. That was taken.
Speaking of the internet, Rollerblades is up to 26 retweets, 40 favorites right now.
Nice.
In the span of our show.
Good,
so that's
internet.
Cool.
That was good. We were recording for our other show on Patreon a good bit, talking lots about Thanksgiving and holiday cheer, and somehow that was born out of it. So if you're interested in what's going to happen, Chapter 3 will be out soon, following all yes. of our holiday escapades. So that's over at patreon.com/goo. We thank you for everything, all of you. We truly do.
No, absolutely. It's that time of year to be thankful for things, and we are thankful for 250 episodes and all of the people who listen and support us via the Patreon.
And I'm thankful for you guys. Can I just say that? You three? This has been fun.
Yeah.
Thankful
yeah, you guys. You're all right.
Kate always new brings to this it love back thing. To reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I am not 250 episodes in love with you three yet, so.
She doesn't want to get in the middle of three guys loving each other.
That's true.
I love it.
Rollerblades is also up to 25 likes on Instagram.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you insta'd it.
I did that while we were recording. A sneaky.
Nice.
Very,
very
sneaky.
And one other final place you can interact with us is on iTunes. It's the fucking month of December, which is crazy to think about.
I know.
So nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable. Head on over to iTunes, no matter what country you live in. We're going to start reading from different countries. I think that's what's going to... That's what's going to change this section of the show up a little bit. But go there, rate and review the show. We appreciate it. And, of course, we'll read some in the coming weeks. Got to collect them from the different countries. But once I do, I'll come up with some good ones to share.
There are so many exciting things approaching everyone at home. We've got season 5. We've got some developments this month. There's just a lot of really, 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 really cool stuff coming as far as the Game of Owns universe is concerned. So, again, thank you so much for being involved. We are forever in your service.
Christmas is coming. So and Hanukkah.
And don't forget, get your owns ready for Arya and John.
Yes. Arya.
Arya.